welcome to the April edition of the Astropod. As usual, I'm one of your hosts, Quinton Goddard.
And I'm the other host, Anna Quiter.
Now it's Easter this month, and the Astropod is packed full of astronomy gems, much like an Easter egg is packed full of chocolatey goodness. Are you excited, Anna?
Yes, you know, I'm really excited because we don't have Easter eggs like that in America, so it's one of the wonderful British cultural traditions that I get to share in.
Well, Anna, I'm really glad you're enjoying those Easter eggs. Now, many Easter eggs have spots, just like Jupiter. And I hear there's something interesting going on with Jupiter's spots, Anna.
Why, yes, Quinton. Well, the University of California at Berkeley scientists have just discovered that from 1996 to 2006, Jupiter's great red spot has been shrinking by a kilometer a day.
Wow, that's really getting smaller. Is it actually going to disappear?
Yeah, so they think it is actually going to disappear someday. You know, it's just a storm, and storms come and go, naturally.
Just like hurricanes do, I guess.
Well, it's similar to a hurricane, because it has, like, the vortex and the circular winds. But it's not like a hurricane in that a hurricane is a low-pressure system, and this system on Jupiter is a high-pressure system. That's what makes it so stable over hundreds of years.
Wow, that's fascinating, Anna. I guess this just goes to show you that Jupiter really is a very active planet.
Yes, it is. So now, I've heard that there's something going on with a satellite mapping gravity. Can you tell us more about that?
That's right, Anna. They finally made a satellite which looks gorgeous. I mean, this is like the supermodel of the satellite world.
Wow.
It's a satellite called GOCHE, and it's designed to measure the Earth's gravitational field, which isn't constant, and it varies depending on where you're standing on the Earth's surface.
Why does it vary?
Well, the Earth isn't a perfect sphere. It's got lots of indentations, mountains, and it's not a uniform lump of material. So they want to try and map out how the gravity changes over the Earth's surface. This satellite is designed to fly in a low Earth orbit, only flying at about 263 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And it's got six very, very sensitive accelerometers inside it, which are going to measure and map the Earth's gravitational field.
What kind of uses do you have for that data?
Well, there's many things you can do with this seemingly innocuous data. Firstly, they're going to apply it to climate models and how the oceans move and how they transport energy, just as the atmosphere does, which depends on the Earth's gravitational field. But not only that, but you can also map the Earth's interior, so looking at the structure of volcanoes and lava fields beneath the Earth's surface, which you can't directly measure. And you can also look at things like ice sheets and how thick they are and how they change over time if you take several readings. So really, Anna, the most important applications for GOCHE are really climate change and hazard warnings for things like volcanoes and earthquakes.
Wow, it sounds like ESA's made a really great investment there.
It is, and it's not an easy project to accomplish. So this satellite's actually got to fly through the upper layers of the Earth's atmosphere. And to do that, it needs a tiny amount of thrust. So they've attached to the back of it what's called an ion propulsion engine, which is firing out xenon, ionized xenon atoms. This could, in fact, be the propulsion system of the future, carrying our future spacecrafts to planets like Mars and further beyond.
Coming up later in the show, we have our live recording coverage of last month's Open Day.
Which was a huge success, with over 1,600 visitors coming to the IOA in one day alone. And I'm very excited that later on the show, I'll be speaking with Professor Andrea Ghez about adaptive optics and how she's using that to look at the black hole at the center of our own galaxy.
And this month's interview was the motivation for the history feature, which is on the history of the ground-based optical telescope.
But before all of those exceptional features, we've got so much coming up in Cambridge that we've just got to tell you about it.
Yeah, this month on April 24th, which is a Friday, starting at 7:30 p.m., there will be a public talk by Jonathan Fay entitled Discovering the Universe with the World Wide Telescope. The World Wide Telescope is software from Microsoft, which allows anybody to browse up-to-date images of the universe from space and ground-based telescopes using their own home computer. So now this talk is here at the Institute of Astronomy, and it's free. And best of all, you do not have to book in advance, so just show up. So Quinton, have you heard any space-based poetry lately?
Well, Anna, I was obviously devastated when the talk Dark Matter, the Poetry of Space, was cancelled the other month. But fortunately, it's been rescheduled, and it's happening on the 28th of April, and the doors open at 7 p.m. right here at the Institute of Astronomy. So I thoroughly encourage everyone to come along, and you can listen to Jocelyn Bell Burnell and Paul Modin, who are going to be talking to James Fenton and Maurice Reardon. Really should be a really interesting evening, trying to mix poetry and astronomy.
I bet your sensitive side will love it.
Certainly will, Anna. Certainly will.
Last month was the Institute of Astronomy's annual Open Day. And while Quincy and I couldn't be there because we were both away in the States, Michelle and Laura said that it was excellent fun fielding your questions. Here are some clips that they gathered.
I'm Alexander Christopher Clark.
And how old are you?
I'm 8.
And where are you from?
I'm from Fenstanton.
Okay, cool. And do you have a question for us today?
Yes.
What is it?
Does space have an end?
Does space have an end? That's a very good question. So the thinking is that space doesn't have an end. It sort of keeps going. But it's like, if you imagine if you were walking around the surface of the Earth, and if you just kept walking in a straight line, eventually you come back to where you started after walking for a very, very long time. So you'd be walking around a circle. Yep. So space is kind of the same, but it has like an extra dimension that we can't really see. So if you were to start walking through space to try and get to the end of the universe, you just keep walking and walking and walking and walking, and eventually you come back on yourself and start and finish where you started. So it's kind of like it's a big ball, but like in a different, it has a fourth dimension, well, another dimension that we can't really measure. Does that answer your question? So it's kind of infinite, but it doesn't really end.
My name is Isabel, and I'm Isabel Dean Smith, and I'm 9 years old and from Peterborough.
You're from Peterborough, so you came up here today for the open day, yes?
Yeah.
And do you have a question you'd like to ask us?
Yeah. When is the next meteorite shower be that we can see from Britain?
Well, the next one we have is called the Lyrids meteor shower, and I think it happens on the 20th and the 21st of April, or the 21st and 22nd of April. So it's sort of towards the end of April, and you'll be able to see it. And the moon will be a new moon as well, so you should be able to see it quite well.
Where will be the best place to see it?
Anywhere that's very dark. So you want to go somewhere where there's not too many streetlights about, because that sort of makes things in the sky harder to see.
Well, if you'd like those little bits from our open day, you'll love our bumper edition. In a couple of weeks' time, we'll be releasing all of the clips from the open day. But now it's time for the astronomy news. Over to you, Laura.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. All aboard the ISS. On March 15th, Space Shuttle Discovery launched from Cape Canaveral, beginning the mission to power up the International Space Station. The shuttle docked with the ISS and successfully installed the final solar array, giving the station its full complement of 6 sets of solar panels. The arrays are used by the ISS to produce electricity from sunlight, and so provide power both to support the crew and enable them to carry out scientific experiments. The power increase also means that the number of astronauts that can be housed on the ISS can increase from 3 to 6. And the new crew members arrived via a Russian space capsule on 26th of March, including the American billionaire Charles Simony, a software designer making his second trip as a space tourist. Although the Discovery mission was a very successful one, it had a slightly less auspicious start. On the day of the launch, it was noticed that there was a bat roosting on the external fuel tank of the space shuttle. NASA assumed that the bat would fly away before countdown. However, during the launch, NASA took a picture of the bat still clinging to the fuel tank as the shuttle passed the height of the launch tower. Later, a wildlife expert was called in to examine the infrared image of the animal to try and work out why it hadn't flown away. It seemed that the free-tailed bat had broken a wing, which explains why it remained on the fuel tank, apparently determined to be the first bat into space. The shuttle's next mission is to repair the Hubble Space Telescope, which will include installing 2 new instruments, repairing 2 inactive ones, and replacing other Hubble components. This will hopefully extend Hubble's life until at least 2014. Is Mars wetter than we thought? The Phoenix lander's exploration of Mars's polar region turned up many exciting results, not least the presence of subsurface ice. New analyses of some images, which apparently show the formation of liquid droplets on the leg of the lander, have suggested that liquid saline water may exist on Mars. When Phoenix landed, thruster plumes removed topsoil, which exposed the subsurface ice and may also have splashed any brine present onto Phoenix's leg struts. But why didn't the brine freeze when it came into contact with the cold Martian atmosphere? The soil in the landing area was found to be rich in perchlorates, a salt containing chlorine. If the drops observed also contained high levels of this salt, then they would freeze at a lower temperature and could remain liquid for a few hours. More evidence of stable subsurface ice on Mars has been revealed by fresh impact craters. These craters were spotted by the high-rise camera aboard NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. These craters are in the mid-latitude region of Mars, which means they will help to constrain how much of the underground ice is stable, like that in the polar regions, and how much sublimates in the Martian summer. These findings carry possible implications for Mars' habitability for future colonisation. The Spirit rover has also made a serendipitous discovery. The right front wheel on the aging rover has locked up, so in order to move from the plateau where she spent most of the winter, she has had to take an indirect route to avoid climbing a slope, and the immobile wheel has churned up a long stripe of bright soil. This might be sulfur or silica-rich soil, which on Earth is formed by hot springs. Astronauts practice journey to Mars. Six volunteers from Europe and Russia will spend 3 months isolated in a capsule in Moscow to simulate conditions for a manned mission to Mars. The crew must now live in the cramped facility until the experiment ends 105 days later, allowing scientists to assess the effects of long-duration spaceflight on their minds and bodies. The aim of the experiment is to imitate the need for complete independence of the crew that a journey to Mars would require. If this experiment is successful, then the space agencies are planning to send six more crew into the isolation facility for 520 days, the estimated duration of a return trip to Mars. That's all the astronomy news for this month.
Thanks, Laura. Now, since this month's interview involves the latest in ground-based optical telescope technology, this month's history section is a look back at the history of the ground-based optical telescope. The first telescope was recorded in 1608 and is attributed to Hans Lippershey, a spectacle maker in the Netherlands. These telescopes were made using a combination of aligned convex and concave lenses and only had 3 times magnification power. The lenses in a telescope are able to magnify light because they collect more light from a distant object than the human eye can collect alone, and they bend that light, magnifying it and refocusing it appropriately for our eyes. Since the defining characteristics of these telescopes are their use of lenses to bend light, and the process of bending light is also called refraction, these telescopes that primarily use lenses for collecting and focusing light are called refractor telescopes. In 1609, Galileo created his own telescope after hearing about Lippershey's invention. Improvements to his telescope allowed Galileo to achieve a 30 times magnification. After using the telescope to look at objects on Earth, Galileo became the first person to turn the telescope towards the sky. For more on Galileo's use of the telescope, please listen to our February podcast. Other scientists, including Kepler, worked on improving refractor telescope design by changing the combination of small convex and concave lenses that they used, as well as the separation between the lenses. However, these telescopes were limited because their lenses couldn't be made larger than about 10 centimeters due to problems with how the glass and the curvature of the lens interact with light, as well as obscuring impurities in the glass itself. Using combinations of different glass types and grinding lenses in more complicated, non-spherical shapes corrected for how the light interacts with the lens. Improving the techniques of glassmaking allowed for the creation of lenses as large as 100 centimeters in diameter. Unfortunately, lenses larger than this were impractical because they are nearly impossible to make without imperfections, and they absorb a lot of light from distant objects because they are very thick, and these lenses are way too heavy to be supported only by the perimeter of the lens. Further, refractor telescopes were becoming unwieldy because the larger the main lens in the refractor telescope, the greater the distance required to separate the main lens from the eyepiece. For example, a telescope with a primary lens of 100 centimeters in diameter would have to be about 19.5 meters long. By about the late 1800s, the world had moved on from making large refractor telescopes. While the world was primarily fixated on refractor telescopes, a set of scientists were developing telescopes that used a curved mirror rather than a lens as the primary light-collecting and focusing device. These mirror telescopes are called reflector telescopes because they rely on the reflection of light from the curved mirror to refocus the light from distant objects. Newton invented the first reflector telescope in 1669. His first telescope was only 15 centimeters long, but it magnified objects almost 40 times, the same magnification as refracting telescopes that were 1 to 2 meters long. These telescopes suffered from problems as well. The mirrors had imperfections, so they did not reflect light very well, and the mirrors could only be spherically shaped. In the 1850s, new techniques for coating and shaping mirrors were created, so the era of large reflector telescopes had begun. Today, The largest optical reflector telescopes in the world are the twin Keck telescopes atop Mauna Kea on the island of Hawaii. These telescopes each have a primary mirror that is 10 meters in diameter. Each primary mirror is made of 36 hexagonal segments that work together as a single mirror. Each telescope is 24 meters high and weighs 272 metric tons. Adaptive optics have been added to these telescopes in order to account for the blurring of light by the atmosphere. And now, to hear more about adaptive optics as the latest development in telescope technology, it's over to Quinton with this month's interview.
Hello and welcome to the interview section of the AstroPod. This month my guest is Andrea Gaze. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Glad to be here.
So Andrea is professor at UCLA. Previous to that, she was at MIT, Caltech, and was a Hubble Fellow at Arizona before briefly coming to the Iowa, where she's now returned to give the Eddington Lecture, which we're all looking very much forward to. So this month, Andrea, you're going to be talking to us about adaptive optics and the black hole at the center of our galaxy. So let's sort of start with the instrumentation part of it. What exactly is adaptive optics?
Adaptive optics is a technique that allows us to correct for the Earth's atmosphere. The Earth's atmosphere is great for us. It allows us to live here on Earth, but it's a real headache for astronomers. So if we use telescopes on the ground, our view of the universe gets distorted. In fact, we lose roughly a factor of 10 in terms of the detail that's possible to study with large ground-based telescope and what's actually achieved if you don't work to correct for this. So with adaptive optics, what we do is we look at something we think we understand, like a star, or in fact, these days, we actually create a star by shining a laser up into the atmosphere and that and creating an artificial star. By observing that star, we can tell how the atmosphere affects us. The atmosphere affects the light from a star very much like a stream affects our vision of a penny at the bottom of the stream. So if there were no stream, you'd see a beautiful penny, but if the stream's there, it gets completely distorted. So the adaptive optics basically holds the stream still to correct for it by using lots of little mirrors to undo what the atmosphere does.
So you essentially try and mimic the effect of the atmosphere on your mirror to sort of cancel it out.
Exactly. In fact, another analogy that one might use is a circus funhouse mirror distorts the way you look. And the atmosphere is doing this on very short timescales, continually introducing different circus funhouse mirrors. And the adaptive optic system does in reverse what the circus funhouse mirror does. So you have to change that mirror on timescales of maybe several hundred times a second to keep up with what the atmosphere is doing.
It sounds like a real technological nightmare to get it all to work properly.
It is, but fortunately it works today.
So how good are the results for adaptive optics?
With adaptive optics today, we can correct for roughly half the damage that the atmosphere does. So it allows us to get to the theoretical resolution of a large ground-based telescope with a little bit of halo left over.
So it's almost like, you know, you're observing from space, but down on the ground.
It is very much like observing from space, except for the ground. And the advantage in this case is that we have much larger ground-based telescopes than we do in space today. The largest space-based telescope we have is 2.4 meters in diameter, and yet on the ground we have telescopes that are as large as 10 meters in diameter. So that means that we can see a factor of four times higher resolution at a certain wavelength.
Now, onto the science bit of the interview, I guess. So you're really looking at the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which seems to be a very sort of popular science topic for the media recently. So just how do you use adaptive optics to look at that black hole?
Well, the question has been, is there a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy? At least that was the original question. And to show that there's a supermassive black hole, which is something you can't see directly, you have to look for its indirect effects on other things, and in particular, its gravitational effects. So a supermassive black hole makes stars orbit it in the same way that the sun has planets orbiting it. So the gravitational field keeps those planets bound, and you can actually measure the mass of the sun by watching the planets. And in very much the same way, we can watch the stars at the center of our galaxy orbit. And from that, we can determine how much mass is inside what volume. And the demonstration of a black hole is a lot of mass inside of a very small volume. The reason adaptive optics was so key to this experiment is that you need to see stars as close to the center of our galaxy as possible. And so without adaptive optics, we couldn't actually resolve the stars that were close enough to orbit on short enough timescale such that we could see them and determine that there was a supermassive black hole there.
It must be a really crowded environment close to the center of our galaxy, with a lot of stars doing a lot of things in a very small volume.
There are a lot of stars at the center of the galaxy. And in fact, astronomers have a nice term for this. We become confusion limited because we can't distinguish the individual stars. And with adaptive optics, we solve this problem of confusion and see the individual stars.
So just how big is this black hole at the center of our galaxy? I mean, you said it was supermassive. Just how super is supermassive?
So supermassive is really big. And by that, we mean 4 million times the mass of the sun. It's the current mass estimate.
It's a real beast then.
Absolutely. But on the scale of supermassive black holes, we're actually kind of on the wimpy side. Supermassive black holes scale from a million to about a billion times the mass of the sun. So we're on the light end of the supermassive black hole scale.
Now, apart from the obvious effect of stars orbiting around the supermassive black hole, what other effects does this have on our galaxy?
You're basically asking, so what? which is a really good question. Why do we care that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy? And the first reason we did this experiment is that you want to prove that these things exist. And at the center of our galaxy, we can come up with the most definitive case for the existence of a supermassive black hole. So that's the first reason we care. The second reason we care is we'd like to understand how the black hole evolves over time, how it grows, how it interacts with its environment. So we can study how matter falls onto it. And it turns out that one of the mysteries with the center of our galaxy is that we don't see much evidence of matter accreting or falling onto the black hole. And how is it that a black hole can gain matter so quietly or so stealthily, I guess one might say. So that's a big mystery. We also see at the center of our galaxy evidence of young stars. And young stars have absolutely no right to be in the vicinity of a supermassive black hole. Supermassive black holes should shred any cloud that might turn into a young star. So in fact, for a long time, people said there couldn't possibly be a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy because people knew that there were young stars. Now we know that we have to solve this problem, and we found young stars even closer to the black hole than were previously known. And these things will be shredded with even stronger, what's known as tidal force, than the stars that we knew at the get-go. So that those are the things that we're really interested in understanding.
Okay. So are these young stars actually forming in the vicinity of the black hole, or are they, you know, being sucked towards the black hole from further away in the galaxy? I'm just, you know, asking questions here.
You're asking excellent questions. So, in fact, we've finally dubbed this problem the paradox of youth. And there are three solutions that you can introduce. Either you can say these actually aren't young stars. These are old stars masquerading as youths. I like to say this is a phenomenon we understand extremely well in Los Angeles. And there, if they are old stars, they've had a long time to be formed elsewhere and to migrate into the center. So that's one possibility. Turns out, doesn't seem to work very well. Second idea is that maybe these are young stars that formed far away where the black hole isn't so problematic. And then what you have to do is put them on an express bus to send them inwards. The problem is we don't know and a mechanism that's efficient enough to bring them in from a region that's safe for formation into this harsh climate of the center of our galaxy. And the third possibility, which looks like it's the right one, is the idea that they really did form where we see them, which means that the conditions when they formed had to be really different than what we see today. In other words, there was probably a massive accretion disk. In other words, there was a lot of gas at the center of our galaxy compared to what we see today that allowed those stars to form. That probably means that our black hole was much more active in its youth.
Well, I was about to ask, normally when we talk about supermassive black holes, we're talking about quasars and very bright, very far away galaxies that are obviously very active. That's why they're called active galactic nuclei. How come our black hole seems to be so quiet? Was there a period in its past when it was active and very bright and had a big accretion disk?
Well, today our black hole is quiet because it's on a diet. There's not too much to feed on it. That's one reason. But presumably, if there was a lot of gas in the past to feed the star formation, our black hole was probably much more active, much like these active galactic nuclei that we see elsewhere in our universe in the past.
Now, I don't want to ask this question, but often I get asked by people, if there's a black hole at the center of our galaxy, are we going to get swallowed into it at some point?
The good news is we're safe, absolutely safe. No danger, no concerns. In fact, once these stars are formed, for the most part, even the stars down at the center of our galaxy are safe from the dangerous effects of a supermassive black hole.
Well, Andrea, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I'm really looking forward to the Eddington lecture.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Quincy and Andrea. Now here's Alex telling us what's up in the sky this month.
Up in the skies this month is the Lyrid meteor shower on the nights of the 22nd and 23rd, so named as the meteors seem to radiate from the constellation Lyra in the east. With an observed rate of about 10 to 20 meteors per hour, this shower isn't particularly spectacular, although since we're approaching the new moon, the sky will be dark in the area, and so observations made after midnight may well be fruitful. Meteor showers are caused when the Earth passes through the debris tail of a comet, and these meteors are all debris from the comet Thatcher. April 26th sees Mercury reach greatest elongation, which means that it'll be its furthest from the Sun in the sky. Wait about an hour after the Sun has set, and then with binoculars and a flat horizon, you should be able to make it out below the Pleiades, which themselves will have a very dark moon pass in front of them later that evening, providing an interesting sight. Orion makes his last stand before succumbing to daylight, and so the prominent constellations this month are, looking south, Virgo, Leo, Cancer, Gemini, and of course, Ursa Major. Of these, the rather faint constellation Cancer is at a good height for observation, and so a good telescope and even big binoculars can make out the Beehive Cluster at its heart, an open star cluster about 600 million years old and containing over 1,000 stars. And finally, Saturn's still high and bright, spending most of its time below the body of Leo this month, with its rings currently 3.5 degrees from being edge-on and opening up to 4 degrees as the month goes on, so they are even just about visible in binoculars. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Quentin and Anna.
Thanks, Alex, for all that fantastic information on the Cambridge night sky. Now this month we've turned the tables on Michelle, who's normally dealing out horrific jokes to the audience. But this month we've got people from the open day to tell some astronomy jokes to Michelle, and here they are.
Why is a thirsty alien hanging around the computer?
I don't know. Why was a thirsty alien hanging around the computer?
Because he was looking for the space bar.
That's really good. Thank you. That's brilliant.
Okay, I'm Paul Fellows from the Cambridge Astronomical Association, and here's my space joke. What do you call a space camel?
I don't know.
Andromedary.
There you go. Very good. Thank you. That was brilliant.
Well, I guess that just goes to prove it doesn't matter who's telling the astronomy joke. They're always pretty painful. Anyway, that's about all we've got for you this month. I'm really glad you've been listening.
Thanks for listening.